CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. The conflict in the Middle East and reporting the conflict in the Middle East. Two huge topics. Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, he teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, writing for Hoover's Defining Ideas, looks at what we've learned about the major media. I'm talking about the global stuff, the newspapers and the TV, these last days of the Middle East conflict. We come to news from Britain. Top BBC executive says, quote, mistake made in reporting of strike on Gaza hospital. This is Telegraph reporting in these last hours. A senior member of staff at BBC News has admitted that the corporation made a mistake while covering the immediate aftermath of the deadly explosion at a hospital in Gaza City. Hamas has blamed an Israeli airstrike for the attack, while the Israeli military said the Ali Arab Hospital was instead hit by a rocket misfired by Palestinian militants. At the Media Society's reporting the Israel-Hamas conflict event, Jonathan Munro, the deputy chief executive of BBC News, said that broadcasters' language, quote, language wasn't quite right during live reporting. The director of journalism at the corporation said the correspondent, John Donison, was wrong to speculate about the causes of the explosion of the hospital. He went on to say, at no stage did Donison actually say it was caused by the Israelis, but nonetheless, when the impression is left that we've speculated, it is important to correct that which we've done. I stop there and welcome the professor to comment on what appears to be the BBC. The metaphor here is useful. Walking back its error on the initial report of the hospital. This representative, of course, of the reporting for the whole from the whole war, how the BBC has been making decisions. You note the word militant in what I just read from the Telegraph. Richard, a very good evening to you. I was encouraged to see the BBC taking a step back. Is it enough, Richard? Good evening to you.
Well, the answer is it's not enough. I think one of the things that I have to say is that its own reporting has always biased it to have a pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas situation, and that the error was not simply one that was random. It was one that was in a biased and predictable way. There was no way that they would ever make the mistake in the opposite direction and accusing Hamas of doing something wrong, which Israel had in fact done. And when you start to have these kinds of biases, it becomes an enormously dangerous thing, because what happens is, given the preconception, it dictates the way in which you think about these events on the ground. And it also means that since you know which way your bias is run, you're willing to speculate because you think, in effect, that's just part of the general mission. So the first thing, in effect, is they never sort of explained the root causes of this situation, which was, in fact, their own political biases one way or another. The second thing they never did is they never explained or apologized for the massive confusions that took place throughout the world. That BBC story went out with such fury and with such broad situation that it basically triggered mass demonstrations throughout the entire Arab world. And all of this stuff is based on a falsehood. It comes back into the United States, and Ms. Talab, she just starts to put it on her personal website as the God honest truth. The evidence starts to come out, and of course she doesn't do anything to take that thing down. And so the lesson that you have to learn from this is making an abject wishy-washy apology 6 days after the event doesn't undo anything that happened in the 6 previous days. And I think what they really had to do is that we are sorry that we embarrassed Israel, that we put them into an impossible diplomatic position, and we're going to take all sorts of steps institutionally to make sure that thing doesn't happen again. I did not see any statement there about how they're going to actually institutionalize the kind of correction that they desperately need to make. And this is not a small issue. As you know, as everybody else knows, and the media become more and more powerful, and to the extent that they could say something, it could be heard by hundreds of millions of people within a matter of seconds or even minutes, and that taking things back is just not the same thing. It's like you're taking about a newspaper, they put a banner headline on top saying something false, they know they're liable for defamation, and so 2 days later there's a retraction box with a single sentence that, oh, we made the wrong mistake on the other hand. And this is even worse than that, because there are other kinds of publications which have similar inclination. I'm horrified every day I read the New York Times because it's so evident what's going on. And the headline that it put was, all the evidence points to the fact that, Hamas had fired the rocket, but some doubt still remained. There was no doubt that remained whatsoever. People have compared this, for example, to, well, do we really know that the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction buried in the ground when we attacked in 2003? Well, we hadn't seen those weapons. All we had was intercepts from other people who may well have been lying to their superior. But in this case, we're not trying to figure out where something is, which we've never seen. We have all the videos, we have all the confirmations and everything else going on. So it's to sort of seed a doubt when no doubt is there. Is also a very serious form of misrepresentation of the underlying situation, which has been characteristic of much of what the New York Times has done. And even on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, you constantly see soft-peddling situations where you're told terrorists, a bunch of militants, but there are lots of people who are militant in favor of good as well as bad cause. So you're introducing a degree of ambiguity into the discussion. And when that ambiguity comes in, the really important narrative that terrorists are wrong and innocent victims are right gets blown up by a series of verbal evasions, which really are, in fact, absolute falsehoods.
Let me mention that the word militant is joined by the word fighter and the word intruder in headlines that you've evidenced in your column, Defining Ideas. In addition, I've noted from the beginning that the Prime Minister of Israel was very careful to present the attack. This is the first hours after he learned the details and the scale as the work of an organization, Hamas, that is like ISIS. This is ISIS. Hamas is ISIS. The connection was made. And Professor, I do not recall from 2014 on when ISIS became a threat to the whole of the world, but especially the United States. I do not recall anyone saying that there is a point of view or a side called ISIS. In fact, the commitment by the United States at the time, President Obama, President Trump, and President Biden right now, is that ISIS must be eliminated as terror. And it's been a puzzle for some time why it is that that connection that the Prime Minister made on the first day has not been made at the major newspapers, understanding that what Hamas did was an act that is unacceptable. There is no side of what Hamas did.
Yes, well, I agree. I think there's the following geopolitical difference. ISIS was a made-up group. Any territory that it claimed was by an immediate context. It had no constituency anywhere throughout the entire system. And so when you eliminated ISIS, it was real easy. Now, the problem in this case is to eliminate Hamas means that you have to attack a illegal government of a large number of people who have a pre-existing identity of one kind or another. And at this particular point, you have to worry about the collateral damage issue, which you did not have to worry about with ISIS. But your point is correct insofar as when you're trying to frame what kind of a group ISIS is, or rather Hamas is, what you must do is to understand that they engage in the same kind of tactics and have the same kind of utterly despicable morality. Remember how they got power. They won an election after the Israelis pulled out. Remember how they kept power. The way they kept power is they threw all the opposition people off the roof so they would not speak against them. I'll ask you the following question, since you know more about this than I do. Who is the prime minister of Gaza that represents the Hamas people? They don't have any legitimate government, no parliament, right?
There's a man, Mishal, but they're gangsters. They rule by the gun. It's the rule of the gun.
They don't sit there and preside over a government. They hire themselves off in Qatar.
That's correct. The leadership is in Qatar, in Doha, and is represented by various characters who do interviews. Mishal, one of the major figures, did an interview with Al Arabiya TV in these last hours where he proposed to exchange the hostages that the Hamas is holding in exchange for all the Palestinians who are in Israeli detention because they're killers. That was his proposal yesterday. There'll be more proposals now.
Well, I mean, this is a great tragedy that Israel has to face. It may be we don't even know whether the hostages are alive or dead, which is certainly a real disadvantage in trying to negotiate. It's also clear that they are likely to be killed one way or another. You can't believe anything they say about anything. And it turns out that there's no acceptable deal that you can make for them, given their number and the demands on the other side. This is the huge moral dilemma that everybody has, real lives against statistical lives. And everybody in this situation is a real life, and all of these people deserve to be free immediately and without condition. But there are statistical lies on the Jewish side. And if, in fact, you try to protect the hostages, you're going to expose many soldiers to greater harms than would otherwise be the case. So this is constant tension of what it is that you do. And there is no equivalence that you could make. The sacrifice that they would want to say is, well, you give us back all these guys. And the incentive for them is, well, we won this time. Let's try the same thing again. And so what happens at this point, I think for the first time, the Israelis realize, regrettably and ugly, it's just terrible, that you have to be more concerned about the prevention of future harms than you have to be about the release of the current hostages. And what you hope is, as the news starts to tighten, what they will do is start to release those people voluntarily in the hope that they may be able to save some scrap of their own infrastructure. But I think when Netanyahu said that the only way this will work is to completely destroy Hamas, he was correct. And then if you could get a Hamas-free Palestine, the Israelis, oddly enough, have to take a lead role in trying to ensure that there's some kind of local government without military power that can handle all the things that need to be done there in a sensible and fair fashion.
I'm speaking with Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, writing at Defining Ideas about the reporting of what is still underway, the fog of war in Gaza, and the threat of a larger regional war. There's some bumpy days ahead, say the newspapers in Europe, and I follow their lead here. So when we come back, what can we anticipate in America these next days when we're going to see combat in Gaza, threats from the north, threats from across the Ummah? What can we expect from our leadership and from the leadership of our distinguished educational institutions? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.